This Coin Week podcast is brought to you by PCGS. PCGS is the standard in the rare coin grading industry. Visit www.pcgs.com to learn more. Since 2003, artist Joel Iskowitz has participated in the United States Mint's Artist Infusion Program. With more than a dozen designs to his name, Joel has a first-person view of the state of contemporary coin design. We talk to him next on the Coin Week podcast. Oh, hi there, Joel. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, Charles. And yourself?
Well, I'm doing well. I'd like to thank you for dropping by on the Coin Week podcast.
It's really my pleasure and an honor to be asked to participate in the forum.
So I hear tell that you wanted to ask me the first question before we really get started.
This is true. The name Charles Morgan rings a bell to us, those of us who pay attention to coinage and art. So I guess I'll reverse the tables and ask you if you have any relation to the great George T. Morgan of the famed silver dollar.
Well, the short and long answer of that question is no. Morgan is a very fortunate numismatic name. In fact, my co-writer and lifelong friend Hubert Walker is a nickname for the Walking Liberty Half Dollar, is also a numismatic name. And when we write our articles as Morgan and Walker, a lot of people actually think these are pen names that we use to sort of sound cool. But nope, these are actually our real names.
It's great. Whenever I see either of your bylines, is part of it. So it's nice to have all that luster associated with your byline, that's for sure.
So, Joel, describe for Coin Week's listeners what your role is in the design process of coins at the U.S. Mint.
I wonder how much time we have, but I'll try and be brief and clear as possible, Charles. Basically, I'm part of the team, which is named the Artistic Infusion Program. Very proud and happy to be a participant in that program. Which actually began back in 2003 under Director Henrietta Holtzman IV, who had the great vision to kind of take a page out of Teddy Roosevelt's desires to have American coinage invigorated by inviting outside artist citizens, to submit designs. So that program that began in 2003, I was accepted into in 2005. And happily here, all these years later in 2016, I still am invited to submit designs for consideration. What I do is I submit two-dimensional black and white line art designs along with the other members of the Artistic Infusion Program. And also the sculptor and engravers in Philadelphia at the United States Mint, who also submit two-dimensional line drawings for consideration.
And from there, designs are scrutinized, and ultimately finalists are selected and submitted to two separate committees, the Commission of Fine Arts, the CFA, and the Citizens Coinage Advisory Committee, the CCAC, where the designs are again reviewed and ultimately recommendations are made and sent to the Secretary of the Treasury. As an artist, what is going through that process like?
That's a good question. It's an elaborate process because even before the designs go to the two national review boards, that being the Commission of Fine Arts and the Citizens Coin Advisory, before it ever reaches that level, all the designs that are submitted undergo a pretty rigorous vetting process from many standpoints, aesthetically, thematically, historically. They're vetted for coinability, and a lot of revisions are done well before they've even reached the National Review Boards. So to answer more specifically, it's a rigorous process for the artist because there's a tremendous amount of time invested in preparing any given design for any given program. An awful lot of time is spent in simply research, as far as I'm concerned, before I even lift up a pencil. And then once that happens, I might go through a number of revisions on my own before I submit, and after that, as I say, before the time comes to present them to the National Review Boards, there's often, you know, a series of revisions needed as well. So it's very time-consuming, and you have to be very, very motivated and dedicated to the work, which I think most of us truly are.
And how would you characterize the level of competition amongst the designers? Are we at a period of time where there's just a pool of tremendously talented artists that your work has to measure up against?
Absolutely. I'd say that incrementally over the years from the beginning of the program, back in the early 2000s, you know, as I say, 2003, 2004, 2005 when I entered, there have been a number of artists that have come through the program. Only a very few have stayed since those years. And as time went on, the roster and quality of artists submitting designs has continually improved. So today, in 2016, I think there's a really, really excellent, probably the best group of artistic infusion program artists on board. So yes, the competition has been enhanced and has tightened. But it's a collegial. I always like to think of it as a collegial kind of friendly competition. It's never been a cutthroat competition, although it's sharp. And of course, the nature of the beast is that only one design for any given obverse or reverse is the one that winds up being selected. So it's a rarity when that happens, but it's always thrilling.
Well, let's talk a little bit about coins. Coins are obviously unique forms of public art. There's a monetary element to it. There's the idea that people are actually using it in commerce. Coins have a sort of intrinsic value and a tradition that is different from tokens and metals or other types of objects. What in your mind makes coins different than metals or tokens or items of that nature?
That's a very, very, very astute distinction. And my mind is reeling with possible responses to that. The first thing that comes to mind off the bat, Charles, is that actually just parenthetically before I thought about the monetary value on a coin, there is one other element because I've had some experience with it. Pieces of miniature artwork, I'd call them miniature / epic artwork, also appear on postage. I've done a lot of stamp designs over the years. So that's another element where art actually has associated with a standard value ascribed by, I don't know, you know, the treasury of any given particular nation. So, yes, it's very distinct in the sense that it has a monetary value for currency in the world of exchange attached to it. And then complicating the issue sometimes is the bullion that's used in any given species, that and then all the historical aspects that make certain coins that are circulating coins collectible and much more valuable than their face value. But it brings another kind of more abstract notion to my mind when you mention that, and that is the subjective arena of attaching value to art. So speaking as an artist, it's always been a very, very, you know, varied scenario. What is art worth in terms of money? what is art worth in terms of its value to a culture? And those are two topics I'm sure that we could, you know, probably fill, you know, a half hour just speaking about in and of themselves.
You know, I'm no art critic, and I consider myself hardly qualified to go too far down this hole. And it's not really a criticism. I'm not making any particular judgment on the art itself. But it seems to me that maybe since the early 1980s, that there's been a shift in the iconography and maybe even the seriousness that this country, and this is not solely this country, because I think it's pretty much every country that produces coins, has when it comes to the motifs and topics that are approved for coin designs. If you look at the circulating coinage of our country after the mint was through with the St. Gaudens period of beautified coin designs, we embraced a modern period with the Washington quarter, the Jefferson nickel, Roosevelt dime, and these types of coins. And these designs stuck around with us with a specific and particular meaning. It's not hard to understand the meaning behind having Benjamin Franklin or Abraham Lincoln or Thomas Jefferson on a coin. And these iconic images stuck with us year after year in a confident display of why America was great. And these coins traveled around the world. And I'd say, starting with the modern commemorative coin series and continuing to the State Quarter Program and America the Beautiful Coin Program and others, it seems that our coin designs have become a little bit more self-conscious in a way, that we no longer seem to be sticking with designs year after year. And the multitude of designs, I think, in some respects, diminishes the object. Do you see where I'm coming from with this line of thinking?
I think I hear you. I think I hear you loud and understand you, you know, quite clearly, and it makes me think that that if nothing else, art is reflective of culture, of society, civilization, sometimes taste, sometimes values. I think actually always it reflects it for better or worse. And I guess a case could be made in general that with the advent of the way in which we digest and exchange information in the digital age, in so many arenas, we could look at what I guess a lot of us would consider a sense of loss of certain tried and true tenets of civilization, of our national values sometimes, in the rush for information and the speed in which it's delivered. Our attention span has been reduced to proverbial 3.5 seconds, it seems. And so sometimes a lot of the lineage and the tradition that are classic, and by classic I mean not any given school of art or any historical period. In my estimation and view, classic means timeless, meaning that it could be appreciated in any age by anyone because certain truths are evident and slash beauty is evident. I don't think those are affected by the passage of time. But what is affected by the passage of time are our tastes or stylistic preferences. And sometimes, I'm being very general now, but I hope it's addressing your question, Charles. Sometimes I really feel that stylistic preferences or the particular taste that prevails in any given age could easily become a kind of limited manifesto and wind up throwing out the baby with the bathwater, proverbially speaking, meaning some of the values that I think you were indicating that might get lost in this modern age, it's lamentable. I think sometimes we do very well to realize there's a continuity, there's a lineage, there's a conversation over time that goes back to the ancients and goes through our history into our present and actually into the future. And I think that's would help you know, all the arts and all the communications that human beings enter into. For instance, you mentioned not only the United States, but I take a look at some of the issues from money to get more specific about coinage. I look at some of the, just artistically, I look at some of the interpretations of Monnaie de Paris, of Le Marianne, you know, their, what would be their, you know, national symbol and icon of the spirit of France, just the way liberty is for us and Colombia was in the past, or Britannia was for Britain. And I see the modern interpretations lacking in their muscular attempt to seem modern, lacking a certain kind of gravitas, a certain kind of connection to the values that you were speaking of. And they wind up looking between you and me, whoever might listen to this podcast. A lot of the modern coinage sometimes looks like it's missing a dimension, that dimension, the dimension of connectivity to you know, these values and these truths and these how can I say it, the quality that's part of classical art.
So how do you think if St. Gaudens or Weinman or Fraser, if they were transplanted into today's industry, how do you think that their art would be affected by contemporary demands on artists as far as it comes to how coins are now produced?
Wow, these are great questions, and they provoke a lot of thought. On one level, if what I said, what I just tried to say to you is accurate, the great classic beauties that they created, Striding Liberty of St. Gaudens, Walker, as we say, you know, Walking Liberty of Weinman, et cetera, they would still do resonate today. They still are alive today. I decry. I get very upset to hear that, that's been done, and those guys are dead, get over it. This is a brutal approach to me. It truncates that lineage. They're not dead. They're alive, and they'll always be alive because they created great masterpieces of great dignity and great beauty that speaks to everybody, the sophisticated collector as well as the very casual exchanger of a coin. I feel that they would like you and myself be a little aghast at some of the imagery that's on some coins today. And that's across the board. That's universally. I also think that their work would always be relevant and valid, and probably producible, as we've seen with the high relief of St. Gaudens. We now have the good part about technology is that it not only has made certain things possible, like the high relief coins, which were always problematic even back in St. Gaudens' day.
Well, let's talk about technology for a minute. How does technology help you in the process of designing coins?
I use technology only as a kind of a necessary tool because that's the way the world is today. For instance, all the designs back in the early days of the Artistic Infusion program, we used to actually send in our original pencil drawings, and we'd send them by FedEx, you know, just actual physical things somewhere in the mint or a lot of in the vaults are actual pencil drawings. But these days, I guess probably since maybe 2006 or 7. Maybe even earlier than that, all the submissions are digital. So even our two-dimensional pencil drawings, and in my case they're pencils, some people use other techniques, are translated into digital programs like Photoshop or InDesign or combinations thereof, and submitted as high-resolution JPEGs. So that by nature, just that alone, has affected the way in which I work. I take my drawings, I scan them in, I make many, many states, I print them out, draw into them again, because you're talking to an old engraver not in the sense of a bas-relief sculptor, but an engraver who was engraved into copper and zinc, engraved into etching. So they're just like with intaglio work, I keep on making many states and refine my drawings. So the technology has helped me because I use my printer basically as an etching press in a sense, and print out drawings and then refine them and scan them in again. So it's helped me and also helps me compositionally, because when I have them in the computer and I'm looking at the compositions, instead of cutting out pieces of paper and moving things, you can do that digitally much more easily. So compositionally, it's very helpful in terms of moving elements and devices around in the field to create a good composition that works in a 360 degree round field.
Do you think this technology in some respects lends to the over-design or the over-rendering of an idea? It seems, speaking as a total amateur again, when I look at the design candidates, the finalists that make it to the CFA or the CCAC, that I see a lot of designs that are, I mean, they're utterly beautiful, but they look like drawings. And I find it hard to imagine that all the shading and intricate detail would end up on a coin as struck. And then I think about how Weinmann's design for the Walking Liberty half-dollar St. Gallen's $20 gold coin, that there's a lot of hide-and-seek going on. There's an allusion to detail that isn't there, that because of the change in the relief that your eye imagines something that isn't fully realized. And sometimes on these modern sketches, I see a load of detail that, you know, on a coin that is one color, you're not going to have all these shadows and things like this.
Well, you might be speaking to one who might be very guilty of that on some levels, but another thought I had is that, a drawing, I've looked at drawings of Weinmann and St. G and people like Victor David Brenner, and what you're looking at or I'm looking at is clear to me, they're sculptors' drawings. And sculptors' drawings, since they're thinking already in three-dimensional bas-relief and various levels of height from the field, they're really making these wonderful direct notes to themselves where they don't need to translate any further. They know exactly what they're going to be sculpting. So they have a very free and bold and, as you say, kind of a hide-and-seek, lost-and-found kind of wonderful look to them, as opposed to a designer such as myself. What we have to do is really create a roadmap for a sculptor in terms of indicating levels of relief through shading or some other way in which to indicate that hatching or shading, and to give a sculptor another hand, another eye, a good guide. As far as details, that's an interesting and intricate question, because as my view of it is, to put it simply, as I said before, sometimes the urge, that muscular kind of strained urge to be modern, mandates, I think, in excess sometimes, the need to follow certain cliches, like, for instance, less is more. Sometimes less is more, and sometimes less is simply less. Sometimes more is more, but if it's done properly, you could put a lot of detail, you could put a lot of refinement into a simple structure. And I think sometimes, there's a mistake when people see a very elaborate amount of care taken in rendering to immediately reject it as too busy or too complicated, where if the trained eye could look at a very elaborate and very refined drawing and see that there's a simple silhouette, a simple island that would read very clearly on a coin. So it's a very, very, it's a very subjective thing in the end, but I think, well, I hope I'm answering some of your concerns in that question. I think they're very valid concerns.
Well, let's talk about the relationship between the designer and engraver. As through your program, you wouldn't be involved in rendering the design in relief, as that would be carried out by an engraver in Philadelphia. Do you have an ongoing correspondence or communication with the engraver during this part of the process?
There used to be a little bit more communication back in the days when John Mercanti was the chief of tool and die and manufacturing, and then later became the 12th chief engraver. He acted very much, very proactively as an art director. I used to call John the eagle eye of Philly because he had such an astute eye. I remember once I had done a portrait of Lincoln, and John said it just was, you know, perfect. He said, but Joel, if you would rotate it 5 degrees to the right, I think it would be improved. And I thought to myself, 5 degrees, will that make a difference? And I, of course, I listened to John. I rotated it 5 degrees, and lo and behold, it read a lot better, and it just looked a lot better. And I think that was the day I gave John that handle, you know, that nickname, Eagle Eye of Philly. He had a great eye. These days, there's much more communication that gets funneled through headquarters and the design specialists interpret language from lead sculptor Don Everhart and such. But after a design is actually selected and there's serious consideration for how it's going to be sculpted and minted, very often the individual sculptor engravers such as Phoebe Hemphill or I've had occasion with Joseph Mena, and others will send me an email or reach out to me directly and say, gee, can you help me with the reference on that fold? Or can you help me with, specifying what you meant by that area? And then I'll come through with either, you know, some reference that I've used or kind of a detailed drawing of that area to help them perform the sculpt.
So once you've gone through the process of rendering your design and submitting it, getting it through the design and revision process, and it's finally made into a real practical object, what's your reaction to seeing it in person?
By and large, it's funny because I've always, my career has mostly been as an artist, although I've done many, you know, paintings and large scale art that hangs on walls and only gets reproduced as a secondary item. I've done a lot of work for reproduction. In the beginning, when I first saw my work reproduced, it's a generation away from an original. So there's always a little bit of a surprise value. But over the course of the years, I've learned to appreciate what my work looks like reproduced. Now, reproducing color work or even black and white work in a vehicle for print is one thing, but having a sculptor, an engraver interpret a two-dimensional design is another thing, because it does become something else. And not only does the bas-relief become something else, it becomes there's a third generation when metals are put under pressure and in the die making process, there's a third generation, and the final coin or metal is yet another level of separation from your original. But by and large, I've gained a tremendous appreciation for the skill, both artistically and then technically, utilized to bring my designs to life, basically. I like to say to new heights. I like to show when I give a lecture, I like to show my drawing alongside of the finished product, whether it's a medal or a coin, so people can appreciate, you know, it can't be exactly the same. One is a design and one is a three-dimensional object in reality. But by and large, if the most recent piece that I had designed and was turned into a minted coin, I'm honored to say that the Theodore Roosevelt America the Beautiful National Parks quarter has just recently been offered to the public, and I think you know, Phoebe Hemphill and the folks in the technical end of things in Philadelphia did an amazing job. That was a very, very complex design, and yet I think it reads simply. I think it was successful from that standpoint. To address your earlier question, there's a lot of detail in there, in the drawing and in the sculpt, but I think it reads simply and it reads clearly. And there are, you know, good negative areas, et cetera, for field and polish. So I guess my simple answer is that I'm edified. I'm really delighted and thrilled when I see the final products.
So you bring up the Theodore Roosevelt America the Beautiful quarter, which just recently launched. Describe the design itself and what motivated your approach to it and what you think it really gets right about that park and the personality of Theodore Roosevelt.
Oh, that one in particular, that was pretty straightforward. The Badlands themselves were compelling, with the outcroppings and the bend of the river, and the whole story, finding out certain things in your research, that this larger-than-life president, this larger-than-life figure in our history, Theodore Roosevelt, suffered so many setbacks right from the beginning when he was a young boy and he was sickly and he had, this larger-than-life father who he adored, who incidentally worked in the Lincoln administration, and he had these tragedies. I think it was Valentine's Day that he lost both his mother and his young bride. And when he left New York and went out to the Badlands on his adventure to find some solace and himself, it's just a very compelling thing. So, having him astride his horse, and looking out over the terrain seemed like the way to go. I did a few different variations. I did one of them off his, actually two, where he was standing, not on horseback, and just surveying the land. But there's something about TR that combined so many wonderful aspects of the American iconography. You know, the cowboy out west, he was wearing a fringe shirt, which was a favorite riding habit for him, and the kind of cowboy hat, and even with the spectacles, there he was surveying the land that he eventually, along with many other gorgeous and valuable prize land, saved. Interesting man, a hunter yet a conservationist. So all these things run through your mind with any given particular program. That one was a very special one for me because of who Teddy Roosevelt was and what he meant for us.
So when you get coins and change, do you look through them to see if any of your designs have been handed to you or are going out to pay for something?
Oh, you bet. You bet. I If I go to the car wash, it's like playing a casino. When I use the cash machine, I don't go to casinos, but I mean, you put in $5 and whatever, you're going to get all these quarters back. And for sure, I go, oh, well, there's, you know, an eagle reverse. But oh, look, I could tell by the nature and the rim on the coin whether, of course, they're going to be ATB quarters or territorial quarters or, you know, state quarters. And I look at them all. I look at them all. And to tell you the truth, the ones that have designs by people I know, fellow artists in the AIP program or sculptor engravers or some of mine, I kind of hang on to them and throw them in the in a little bowl on my desk. I get a tremendous kick out of seeing those or getting them in change at the bakery or whatever. If I check them out all the time. See, one I'm very, very, very proud of is the Humble Lincoln Scent. In 2009, I was fortunate enough to have one of my designs chosen for the Bicentennial Illinois Scent, the third aspect, Lincoln's professional years in Illinois. And very proud of that. It connects me to Victor David Brenner, you know, in a sense, and Lincoln, of course, is also connected to Roosevelt. As I said, you know, his Theodore Roosevelt Sr. served in Lincoln's administration, and gave Teddy a ring with hair embedded in amber or something on it as a gift to use on his hand when he took the oath of office. So all these, you know, connections go through my mind. But I was very, very, very honored to be part of the Lincoln Scent lineage in history.
You know, I think if I was an artist, I'd be insufferable. I mean, every time I'd get a coin I design and change, I'd tell the person that gave it to me, hey, I designed that. Or if it was a girl I was trying to pick up at a bar. And, of course, they would shoot back and say, oh, sure you did.
Yeah. Yeah. It's. I'm sure I speak for everyone. I think everyone, especially in the AIP who are, you know, contracted artists and kind of citizen artists, the pride you get when some of your design work is represented on a coin or a medal is it's immeasurable. I've gotten an opportunity to design congressional gold medals, and actually one of the wonderful perks with that is being invited to the ceremony. You get to see these American heroes receive their just due, sometimes after a very long wait, and it's really stirring. It's as stirring as it brings me back to when I was in elementary school, when live dinosaurs roamed the earth. It was a while back, but when you get to be a color guard and carry the flag or you hear the national anthem, I still get chills. And that kicks in when a design of yours is selected. You know, you become a small part of that great history. So it's magnificent. And the other thing about coinage that's so wonderful, you mentioned it earlier, you know, Charles, is that, you know, they're miniature pieces of art, but they address epic stories. So yes, the challenge to, you know, distill an epic story and put it into a circumference of at largest 3 inches in case of a congressional gold medal and as small as a cent, it's a huge challenge. But it's so thrilling to know that art, those miniature ambassadors, travel among the society at their own pace and at their own will, uncontrolled by review boards or museums or arbiters of taste. People get to experience them and learn from them in their own natural way, running the gamut from, as I say, you know, the casual spender, you know, of coins who happens to notice, hey, that's Duke Ellington on the back of that quarter, all the way up to, you know, erudite and knowledgeable collectors such as yourself and others who know every detail, most of which I have forgotten about the history of coinage. So it's very exciting that this is art that travels to the people as opposed to hopping in the family car and going to a museum to visit the art. The art visits the society, which is thrilling to me.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. Of all the coins in the U.S. series that you're familiar with, which would you say is your favorite design of all time?
Of all time. So now we're well beyond my own favorite that I produce my chubby little fingers as a design. I think, you know, although, and this is very controversial, I mean, St. Gaudens the high watermark, a great sculptor, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful coin, Striding Liberty, and quite beautiful, considered the most beautiful American coin. But you know what? I think the design of Wineman's Walker is, the walking liberty of Adolf Wineman is just about as perfect a design as you can make in the round. It just sings. It just does everything that great design is supposed to do in my mind. The breakup of the space, the abstract elements, the compositional construction within the round is perfect. And interplay of negative and positive space, and then even more so the content, the way in which in his time and space he evoked liberty as this dynamic figure moving with flowing the robes becoming the red, white, and blue. It was just a combination of so many elements working together perfectly. So, you know what? I'd have to say my favorite American design of all times would have to be Wineman's Walking Liberty.
I wanted to hear your thoughts on this issue. We've had presidents on coins for quite a long time. And believe it or not, that was a controversial decision when the president started to replace allegorical representations of liberty. Do you think that putting presidents on coins has locked us in indefinitely to this type of design? Or do you think at some future date we might revisit this and redesign all of our circulating coins?
That's a wonderful question, Charles. And, you know, it makes me think of two things. It makes me think of, the precursor to Teddy Roosevelt, and really Teddy Roosevelt and Victor David Brenner, in the absence of St. Gaudens, kind of conspired to break the precedent that our first president, George Washington, warned about. He very, very brilliantly and, with great foresight said, do not put my likeness on a coin. You'll make me a sovereign. And in America, the people are sovereign. You know, wonderful, visionary genius, I think. And then fast forward to 1909, as you mentioned, and a larger-than-life president, build the Panama Canal and break all kinds of precedents just through the force of his incredible will, conspires in Oyster Bay, sitting for Victor David Brenner's portrait as he's sketching Roosevelt. I did a lithograph of this. I'll send it to you one time, of Brenner sitting in Oyster Bay and Roosevelt's library, sketching him, and Brenner having the good presence of mind to bring along his plaque that was later to be used on the cent, the profile of Lincoln. And breaking the precedent of putting only allegorical figures on coins for fear of deifying a human being. Well, Lincoln deserved that kind of respect, and I'm glad that precedent was broken. And incidentally, as you probably well know, of all the art produced in the world, the Lincoln cent is the most reproduced object of art in history. answer to the second part of your question, I'm so glad that the president, certainly the presidents, all 44 and all the rest will deserve to be depicted on a coin. But yes, I do believe there's a lot of thought about redesign of circulating coins, and I do believe, and rightly so, there's a talk about reinstating new interpretations of allegorical themes, liberty, justice, things like that, which I think would be a great continuation of that lineage. So, no, I don't think it's a bad thing that presidents have been put on coins, but I do think it would be a good thing to revisit some of the allegorical themes, especially in the circulating coins.
Well, it brings to mind the issue that we've had with currency in the last year or year and a half, when a group of women agitated and lobbied for a change on the $20 bill to take Andrew Jackson off and replace him with an important historical woman. Not a depiction of an allegorical woman, but a historical woman. And it seems to me once you game plan out the politics of not only the acquiescence to the idea, but then the reaction against it, which played out in the public square, it seems to me, on the one hand, you have a problem with representation. We are a diverse country, and we recognize that now more so than we did 125 years ago. We're also, I'd say, richer because of that diversity, and a lot of things have happened in the last 50 to 100 years that really isn't represented at all in our currency or our public art. It seems like the great age of public art is in the past, however, and that we don't invest as much time or thought or money or attention to it. And of course, there are all sorts of reasons. You can go into the political arguments that have been waged over the National Endowment for the Arts and other things. And I don't think in the scope of our conversation that's worth going down that rabbit hole. But when I think about the argument that taking a figure like Andrew Jackson off of a bill and replacing him with Harriet Tubman or Rosa Parks or somebody else, it's like taking away something from the culture in order to give something to a smaller subgroup of the culture. And there seems to be a lot of animosity to that idea. And I don't know necessarily how fair that is. I mean, I view Harriet Tubman as an American hero. And what she did was good for all Americans, not solely for American women or Black Americans. But it seems that this is the argument that happens. And it seems that having George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln on a coin or currency note makes it all that much more difficult imagining a concept where somebody comes along to replace these figures. It's as if we are measuring the value of the replacement against the person they are replacing. And I think that's the danger of putting these people on the coins and currency notes in the first place.
I think you make a very valid point. The only caveat or exception I'd put in is that, again, when TR broke that precedent, that very, very well thought of precedent that began with Washington, which was very much in keeping with what the American experiment was about, that we're not going to have a king. We're not going to make anybody more important than anybody else. It's essentially very democratic, a country of equals, before the law and before the eyes of all individuals. So you make a good point. The only thing is, Lincoln was so revered beyond words that I could express, so dearly beloved for what he accomplished in saving the Union when it was truly the whole nation really when it was at threat. If you're going to make a precedent breaker, Lincoln was the individual to put on our coinage, it seems to me. So I can understand that at the turn of the century in the progressive era when the Wright brothers were flying around, the world was changing. But yes, when you do that, you do fall into that arena. I agree, Charles, that, obviously, who we put on our paper notes and our coinage represents our most revered ideals and individuals in this case. But if you start swapping them, are you denigrating those who get replaced? If Roosevelt, Franklin Delano, winds up off the dime as he become passé, you know, it brings all these interesting political questions and kind of ethical and moral questions, really, you know, of, you know, should we be subjective and use a measuring stick to what I'd like to think is that certainly Harriet Tubman deserves to be on either, you know, a Federal Reserve note or on a coin. I actually did a private sector piece of Harriet Tubman on coinage. So certainly she deserves it, but maybe even though Andrew Jackson was not particularly always a choir boy when it came to individual rights as vis-a-vis his relationship with the Native Americans, it would be better, it seems to me, to add, you know, make a five, a new, you know, $2 bill, or make a new $3 bill, or a new, I don't know what the, you know, and add someone rather than take someone off and kind of negate their relevance, whether they were approved of or not. I mean, Jackson's a very good case for someone who a lot of people didn't approve of a lot of his policies, but historically he deserves to be as a president. If we're going to have presidents on our coinage and on our species, he deserves to be there as much as Lincoln or Millard Fillmore, for that matter.
Well, what I would have advocated if I was in the Treasury Secretary's position would be a complete overhaul of all of them and say the presidents have served greatly, and now it's time to give them a rest and recognize 20th century innovators. So now you have the Wright brothers and the space program, whatever it is. Now it's a theme that affects and reflects all Americans. At that point, you're not making a historical judgment of one figure or another. You don't have to demean them to replace them. And in some respects, I think that was the mistake in the Jackson replaced by somebody else argument. Because all of a sudden, you're trying to unfairly measure a woman who lived in a time of America's history where we were fighting a war over the issue of human bondage, in an era where there was not yet woman suffrage, against the democratically elected president of the United States. And then the defenders will say, well, he's more important. And obviously, based on that measurement, it's obvious that a president would be more important. But at the same time, it shouldn't be an argument about comparing people's records. It's really about whether we have the freedom to view ourselves in a different light from time to time. And that argument gives away too easily to the tribal battles we keep having in this country about our history, about iconography, and who we are as a people.
I think you make a really valid point that you know, if our diversity is not curated carefully, it could lead to you know, division and separation, which is not what's wanted. So I agree with you, and I applaud, by the way, I think a wonderful cure to some of the pitfalls of what you're talking about is this. I hope the new innovation dollars become law. I also hope that a board on the program and get invites to submit designs, because I think it's a wonderful, I think that's a wonderfully democratic, as you say, it's a much more open-ended, non-judgmental recognition of the American colloquy, you know, of our conversation, of what we've accomplished, you know, as Americans. And so I think that would be a wonderful follow-up to, you know, the state quarter dollar program and the ATB program. And I think probably a more successful follow-up to the presidential dollar coin program.
Well, if that program went into effect, it would certainly fulfill my lifelong dream of having the sham wow appear on a coin.
Did you invent that, Charles?
No. I don't know if things like the ShamWow are actually ever invented, or if they just exist as fever dreams for the insomniacs that watch late night TV. So, Joel, thank you so much for stopping by and taking the time to share the story of your involvement in the pageantry of American coin design. I'm sure CoinWeek's readers and listeners will learn as much as I did in talking to you.
I appreciate that so much, Charles, and it's been a pleasure, speaking with you. And I hope that some of my rambling comments made some sense to you, and hopefully to some of the people that listen in.
I'm sure they did. I look forward to talking to you again soon, Joel.
Thank you, Charles. Speak soon. Thank you.
If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends. And remember, you can download all 40-plus episodes of the CoinWeek podcast for free from the iTunes Store. For CoinWeek, I'm Editor Charles Morgan, signing off. Until next time, happy collecting.